Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 187, recorded for the week of November 2nd, 2022. Google Blockchain Engine, a day late and a Bitcoin short. Good evening, Jonathan and Ryan. How's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Not bad. 187. I felt like we got to the 180s about months ago. I've been stuck here ever since.
I mean, we did take a 2-week vacation.
We did take a 2 weeks off, yeah, but still.
So, I mean, yeah, so technically this would be 190 if we hadn't taken 2 weeks off. So, Peter, unfortunately, is not with us tonight. He had family over and did not invite us to visit with his family. So, yeah, it's all fine. But we have, of course, lots of interesting things going on in the cloud, as always. And I am not prepared to play my favorite sound, but let me do it now. It is earnings season once again, and the earnings were not pretty, I will tell you right now. So first up, Microsoft exceeded expectations on revenue and profits, but cloud revenue was lower than expected and quarterly guidance fell short of expectations with plans to moderate their expense growth over the next few quarters. Revenue was $50.12 billion, beating analyst expectations of $49.61 billion in revenue, and net income fell by 14% due to a prior year $3.3 billion tax benefit. But to apparently counteract this, they're making all their Azure servers and network last 6 years instead of 4, so those failure rates can go right on up, which gave them an $859 million bump to net income in the fiscal quarter. Microsoft Intelligent Cloud only generated $20.33 billion in quarterly revenue, up 20%, but analysts said they were going to do 20.36 because they're bad at their jobs. Azure revenue specifically grew 35% in the quarter compared to 40% in the prior quarter. And overall, this meant that their stock price dropped 6% based on weak guidance. But everything else was good. So Microsoft did okay.
Yeah, that 6 years instead of 4 is quite an extension of life.
Yeah. The failure rates, when I read the Backblaze hard drive failure reports, you know, as you see the drives and as they're aging through, the number of failures definitely starts to go up quite a bit after that 4-year mark. It was one of those interesting things to see that, you know, that all that industry noise that we make about 3-year life cycle is a real thing. The data proves it.
Yeah. I also read this week that Facebook are doing the same thing in their data centers and extending their servers by an extra year or two.
Do you think it's whether they want to save money or is it that they can't get servers because the supply chain is so jacked still from COVID? Yeah.
It's how it looks on the books. This takes me back to my old data center days. I've had to pull this move. Hey, all of a sudden my capital expenditure is
not as bad as it was before. Yeah. I can see that too. Like I definitely one of those, you know, but like to go back and recapitalize assets, to make them 4 to 6, like that takes recertifying some of the books, doesn't it? So it's not an easy thing to do or something to do trivially. So talk to an accountant before following suit.
Yeah.
Well, poor Alphabet. Alphabet had a rough quarter as well. They missed both the top and bottom revenue expectations from the analysts. Apparently, driven by YouTube's decline by about 3%, and total growth was only 6% for the quarter, marking the weakest period of expansion since 2013 for Google. But the revenue was $69.09 billion versus the $70.58 billion expected. YouTube was only $7.07 billion versus $7.42 billion. And Google Cloud revenue was apparently the bright spot, achieving $6.9 billion in revenue versus only $6.69 billion expected by the analysts. It is a notable increase from the $5 billion in the same quarter a year ago, but the losses widened to $699 million up from $644 million a year before. Sundar Pichai is enacting cost-cutting measures across the company, citing economic challenges, including a potential recession, soaring inflation, rising interest rates, and tempered ad spend. They also canceled their next Pixelbook laptop, cut funding to its Area 120 in-house incubator, and last month they killed Stadia, which I am convinced was because of me. So I had been paying for this service I was not using for 8 months, and then finally said, I should kill that, and I turned it off, and like a week later, they killed the service. So it's all my fault. I'm sorry.
I wonder how much that YouTube revenue drop is because of the success of things like TikTok.
A lot.
A lot.
Honestly. You know, they don't mention that.
It's a one-to-one sort of.
Yeah. I mean, YouTube has copied the short reel format that Instagram copied that TikTok's famous for. So, like, everyone's copying that model. It's got to be related.
Yeah. No, it's I think in social media, that space, like it's a cutthroat, you know, thin margin business, and, you know, advertising dollars are going to go to where the eyeballs are. And right now TikTok has got all the eyeballs.
Yeah. And now we got Elon Musk talking about bringing Vine back to Twitter, which was one of the first short reel.
That was you know, thinking about
Vine. I mean, that was the granddaddy, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It started kind of the whole idea, but I think wasn't Vines, they were only like limited 10 seconds or something very short. They were too short, where, you know, the 60-second timeline of TikTok seemed to really drive the right attitude. And so if they just kept Vine around and extended to 60 seconds, they could have been TikTok.
I find it funny that there's that sweet spot, right? Like, who would have thought, you know, all these years you thought YouTube and videos that, you know, were longer, like they used to incentivize longer videos for monetization. And then, you know, Vine was too short, so it died. And then, you know, apparently it's that our attention spans are about two and a half minutes.
And then rounding us out is, of course, Amazon.com. Their stock did not do well, a 16% hit on their weak fourth quarter guidance. They missed the analyst expectations and coupled with that forecast for Q4, which is a bad sign for the overall retail industry in general, because Amazon's Q4 is typically their best quarter of the year and for all retailers due to the holiday season. The fact that they're already down projecting their expectations is not a good sign for that upcoming recession. Revenue was $127.1 billion versus $127.46 expected. AWS came in at $20.5 billion versus the $21.1 billion expected. Amazon forecasts a 2-8% growth for the fourth quarter of $140 to $148 billion, but analysts wanted their growth to be $155.15 billion, and so that's why they were penalized. Income fell by almost half to $2.53 billion from the prior year's $4.85 billion, and AWS accounted for all the profits plus some, as the cloud unit generated income of $5.4 billion. However, AWS posted the slowest growth in revenue since 2014, with only 27.5% growth in the quarter, missing analyst expectations once again. And then Gartner also dropped AWS 2 points in market share from 41% to 39% of the overall cloud market recently, which is not great. There's a quote here: "The ongoing macroeconomic uncertainties have seen an uptick in AWS customers focus on controlling cost, and we are proactively working to help customers cost optimized, just as we have done through our history, especially in periods of economic uncertainty. The breadth and depth of our service offerings enables us to help them do things like move storage to lower price tiered options and shift workloads to our Graviton chips." I think this is from the CFO of Amazon.com, Ol Sevesky. So not a great earnings report in general for the cloud providers. Cloud did okay for AWS, did okay for Alphabet, but not so great for Microsoft. So, you know, no one knows what's happening specifically in the cloud market these days.
Yeah, it's like our gain is their loss, really. We can turn down auto scaling groups and turn off stuff that we didn't commit to. And that's fantastic for all the customers, but not so great during an economic downturn for somebody whose business model relies on the consumption.
Very true.
I mean, I'm not going to feel too bad looking at the revenue numbers. Like, yeah, they missed expectation, but they're still making billions and billions of dollars. So
yeah, they're not hurting anything.
I'm okay. Yeah.
Well, the Magic Quadrant for Cloud Infrastructure and Platform Services has been published for the 12th consecutive year. AWS is the leader in the Magic Quadrant, which, you know, is no surprise to anybody. Shocker. Who's in the cloud space. Yeah. Gartner says that there are many strengths and weaknesses for each of the cloud providers. AWS's main strengths: breadth of functionality, current market share lead, and they're vibrant. It's exciting. I don't know what they mean by vibrant. Oh, vibrant and prosperous ecosystem. I didn't write the full note. That's what happened. Cautions for them is eroding customer relationships, which is, I think, the second year they've mentioned this particular issue. Multi-cloud and sovereign strategy is weak, and the regional dependencies and communication outside of the US is somewhat suspect. Google strengths, revenues and capability gains, sales execution, and their sovereign cloud, they think, is a definite differentiator between Azure and AWS. Their cautions, though: that price increase dinged them hard. Increasing prices, of course, strategic confusion about what Google's really trying to do, and the mounting financial losses in the Google Cloud business. Microsoft got market share, solutions orientated, and hybrid and multi-cloud strengths. But their cautions were security issues and lack of innovation. Ooh, that's harsh. Opaque costs and punitive licensing, which sort of makes me laugh, because the next one I'm going to talk about is Oracle, which did not get dinged for punitive licensing, but dinged for something else. Strengths for Oracle: business model innovation, their multi-cloud architecture, and their market responsiveness. Their cautions are, of course, the brand reputation of Oracle, the non-Oracle mid-market, small and mid-sized business, and MSP partner ecosystem is a bit of a struggle. So overall, not anything I wouldn't have expected to see in the quadrant. The ding on customers, again, for AWS, I think that they haven't fixed that in a year is sort of bad. But hopefully they'll figure out what they need to do. And then, of course, Google raising prices hurt them pretty badly in the quadrant. And then AWS with their predatory pricing models against all their competitors for SQL Server in particular, I think, is their big ding.
Those eroding customer relationships, you think that's a specific thing still? Like the Elastico deal that kind of went a bit sour, or is it just in general there upsetting customers?
So Gartner says, client inquiry surfaces that AWS often optimizes for the short term when dealing with customers, particularly the time of contract renewal, resulting in eroding customer relationships. And so this is really about, if you're not growing, they're not giving you discounts. And then, of course, they have the executive management changes, changing customer priorities, and then providers' preferences in various regions. And while competition paint a challenging picture for AWS ahead, per Gartner.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about them losing market share to 39%. I mean, there's still an enormous number of people still to move to cloud. So it's,
I mean, if they calculated in the market share of people who are not on cloud, I think the number is still pretty massive.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you guys are not wowed with the Magic Quadrant. Anybody in the quadrant you guys are surprised about? I do think it's interesting. IBM keeps dropping farther and farther to the left in niche players.
you want to talk about lack of innovation, right? Like, it's really difficult for, I think, IBM to compete, since they're really just trying to focus on compute and hybrid workloads. So it's really hard to sort of offer something there that you can really use or build a platform on top of. I really wonder how long it'll be till Alibaba is up there with the Microsoft and AWS, because they keep rising, conversely.
Well, I mean, I think if you're going to China, your choices are Tencent, Alibaba, and Huawei. So I think, it's always the risk of what you want to do in those particular areas.
Well, I think that they'll eventually, what you'll start seeing is more global workloads, I think. There's some network latency and stuff, but to be considered. But if you can get, compute at the edge and diversify that way, I can see people move in that direction.
Yep, for sure. All right, let's move on to AWS news. Jonathan, this one you must be really proud about. AWS is announcing the Amazon Neptune Serverless, the fully managed graph database that adjusts capacity to your workloads, is now generally available. Amazon Neptune is a fully managed graph database, of course. You could do this prior. It would manage things like provisioning, patching, backup, recovery, failure detection, repairs. However, managing your database capacity for optimal cost performance requires you to do capacity planning. Dun, 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 dun. With Neptune Serverless scales automatically as your queries and workloads change, adjusting capacity in fine-grained increments to provide just the right amount of database resources that your app needs at this moment. In this way, you pay only for the capacity you use and use Neptune Serverless for deployment, test, and production workloads, and optimize your database costs compared to provisioning for peak capacity. Neptune Serverless supports the same query languages, Apache Tinkerpop Gremlin, SoapAndCypher, and RDF Sparkle, and features snapshot streams, HA, and database cloning. There's a quote here from Wiz, the security cloud team. At Wiz, we use Amazon Neptune to identify and map toxic combinations of cloud risks to reveal which of these pose the greatest threat. This allows our customers, including over 25% of the Fortune 100 and some of the largest cloud environments in the world, to fix what really matters, says Roy Resnick, co-founder and vice president of research and development at Wiz. With Amazon Neptune, serverless graph database workloads scale automatically to meet demand, so we never need to worry about managing database infrastructure and capacity, and can instead focus on delivering more value to our customers or trolling all the hypercloud providers on our block.
I mean, I'm kind of excited by this. It's something that I asked for a long time ago, but it's not. I'm going to say it's not quite as serverless as something that doesn't cost you anything to have it running unless you're making queries. I mean, this is serverless in that you don't have to do that capacity management yourself, but it is still scaling up and scaling down capacity units on the back end, and it's a process that does take time. So it's, I think it's kind of like pushing the definition of serverless a little bit more than I'd like, but it certainly makes it more affordable to use.
I mean, would you see service degradation if it's, scaling event and you're at capacity? while it's in process, but then it would just automatically restore because.
I don't know. I mean, you can deploy read replicas, which I assume you could continue to read from without latency as it scales up other parts for writes potentially.
I mean, I'm just confused on what, like when you say it's not serverless because, I mean, you're not logging into the things to maintain them and you're not, are you scaling this up and down? I thought you were allocating,
I mean,
like compute units.
It's automatically scaling up and down, but you still pay per compute hour. Whether or not you're making queries.
Oh, okay. I get it. That's what
it's a bit more serverless. And like I said, definitely a lot less expensive.
So it's more like the old days of compute where you were, if you fired up an instance, it was yours for that hour, whether you shut it down or not.
Right.
Makes sense.
Anyway, that Wiz use case is awesome though. Graph databases are perfect for mapping out exactly those kinds of relationships that security people care about. That's a lot of technology for graph databases came out of intelligence services, basically.
Yeah.
For that very reason.
It's fascinating. I still have yet to figure out a workload where it would make sense for me to actually like really learn what that is and what the pros and cons are. But, you know, this said to the guy who's just now learning SQL. So.
AWS Batch for Amazon EKS is now available to you in general availability. If you love the idea of using containers for scheduled workloads, this is a great announcement for your use cases. It's ideal for customers who no longer want to shoulder the burden of configuring, fine-tuning, and managing Kubernetes clusters and pods used with their batch processing workflows. And even better, there is no additional cost for the batch control plane outside of everything you have to spin up to run it. But, you know, technicalities, AWS, technicalities.
Yeah.
AWS Batch for EKS offers you a fully managed service to run batch workloads using clusters hosted on EC2 with no need to install and manage complex custom batch solutions. AWS Batch provides a scheduler that controls and runs high-volume batch jobs together with an orchestration component that evaluates when, where, and how to place jobs submitted to a queue. There's no need for you as the user to coordinate any of this work, and you just submit a job request into the queue. Job queuing, dependency tracking, retry tries, prioritization, and compute resource provisioning is all handled for you natively in the managed service.
Or just use Knative.
I still like batch in general just continues to elude me. Well, I don't really see the advantage over, you know, I've only used it with ECS, but the advantage over just managing workloads and, you know, like, cause it's almost always the details prevent you from really just turning this over. So scheduling a job and just having a crunch a thing almost never works without really sort of curating that workload a bit. So maybe I don't have the right use case, but I just don't see the advantage. And if this is anything like the ECS offering, it's still running all that stuff. It's still running compute in your VPC in your account. And it's still servers that are taking up IPs. And I
don't really understand what it matters if your batch job runs on Fargate or if it runs on ECS or if it runs on EKS, if they're fully managing for me. It seems like a triviality. Unless I guess someone has it defined in YAML files for Kubernetes and they don't want to convert them. Like that's the only reason I could think it matters.
Well, ECS, batch on ECS only supports jobs in a single container, though. So at least you can deploy pods with multiple containers sharing parts of the workload or doing different parts of the workload with networking between them.
Is that a single container limit? Like, because, I mean, ECS tasks can support multiple containers. And I thought that batch supported ECS tasks. So like, I think you could get away with it. It's just a little clunkier than when you're trying to use the Kubernetes.
Maybe it's just the way we're using it. Anyway, I guess it sits in a nice place for longer running jobs than you could justify using Lambda or more jobs than you could justify using Fargate for. So I guess it sort of fits a little niche somewhere.
Yeah.
You know how we've made fun of the mobile app for months now of how limited its use is.
Oh yeah.
So they announced a feature from the mobile app that's super duper helpful if you don't mind typing on a iPhone or Android device, AWS EC2 reboot instances --instance-ids-i1235690 on a phone screen. You can now do that with the AWS Cloud Shell for mobile. which is now available to you right away on the mobile application, which again, I make fun of this because it's a funny thing, but that's what I've wanted to do all along, is just be able to do that kind of stuff on a pinch when I'm in, on the road. And you can run any of the AWS CLI commands for over 250 services while on the go, all from your expanded mobile application. It does have an expanded mobile keyboard when using AWS Cloud Shell, so you can take inputs such as tabs, controls, alts, and escapes, which you might need for your console, which is not part of the native keyboard.
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah, because especially if it does tab completion within that, you know, like, might actually be handy. But yeah, emergency use only. I can see myself making so many typos and killing the wrong thing just because, you know, fat thumbs on a little tiny screen.
Yeah. Now we can call you when you're on vacation. Yeah, they've got no reason not to not to log in and do work. No laptop, no problem.
Yeah,
I can't. You know, but my iPad is not provided by my company, so I can't connect to the company VPN. So I can't do things still. Sorry.
Yeah,
I'll just keep coming up with excuses.
And I've lost my phone by purposely leaving it buried in the desert under 6 feet of dirt.
Well, the AWS Fault Injection Simulator, or FIZ for short, now supports network connectivity disruptions as a new FIZ action type. Using the new disrupt connectivity action in AWS FIZ, you can inject a variety of connectivity issues as part of your AWS FIZ experiment. Connectivity issues include disrupting all traffic to a VM or instance, or limiting the disruption to the traffic to and from a specific AZ, VPC, custom prefix list, or specific service. So you can test all of your failure modes and operations.
That's awesome.
This is super cool. I was especially excited by the custom prefix list, just because that you can simulate the failure of workloads that are not in your AWS environment with that, which I think is, you know, really neat for, you know, in the multi-services, or sorry, the microservices sort of ecosystem that many companies live in. So this is pretty rad.
I mean, have you guys ever, like, what type of scenarios would you want to test with it? Like, specifically, which ones would you want to detect?
I mean, so for mostly, scaling when failure is an interesting sort of thing to search out. So when you lose an AZ and traffic shifts over from one thing, what I've seen is that, you know, you're within an AZ or within a smaller, you know, region or subnet, you end up hitting limits and stuff that you wouldn't really expect. So those are the types of things that I think you'll catch with this sort of thing. I also think that there's, if you test like the prefix, you can, you know, there's a subset of traffic that's not, you can designate as not working versus just turning it all off. And I think you'll get more granular results in your failure mode there.
Which is great for DR testing. Mm-hmm. Prove that your application does the thing that you said it's going to. Prove that you have the database resilience and that you're not going to end up with split brain, things like that.
Yeah.
Those are good use cases. Those make sense. Well, the AWS Private Certificate Authority now offers you short-lived certificate mode, a lower-cost mode for AWS Private Certificate Authority designed for issuing short-lived certificates. With this new mode, public key infrastructure admins, builders, and devs can save money with issuing certificates with validity of 7 days or fewer. If you use certs for conveying privileged access, such as IAM roles anywhere, short-lived certs may offer better security because they expire quickly rather than relying on the need to revoke the certificate with longer validity periods.
And it's so cheap, down from $400 a month to $50 a month for a CA that supports this. So finally, it's like,
oh really?
Reached the realm of affordability.
Oh yeah, I didn't know that. So I've never played around with the private CA just because I was like, oh, I'm not
scared to
not
going to
do $500 for a POC.
Yep.
And then Amazon is announcing Amazon EKS Anywhere now supports Apache Cloud Stack. And for those five listeners who know what Apache Cloud Stack is. Apparently, it's another way to run VMs inside of your data center, like VMware or KVM or others as well. This now allows you to now provide your EKS Anywhere stack to CloudStack, Bare Metal, or VMware now available.
That's, I mean, it's a bigger deal if once you know what CloudStack is, because you can, it has an AWS compatible API and you can use it to deploy instances on VMware or other clouds. Or AWS, and so
it's open source,
yeah. And it's, so it really just kind of levels the playing field as far as managing hybrid workloads. And so, you know, EKS anywhere on cloud stack is kind of verging into the Anthos territory.
That's pretty clever. Yeah, I actually didn't know it existed at all, but now I do. I don't have a use, but, you know, I was so used to OpenStack being really the only sort of open source provider for those things. So this is neat.
It's something I'd like to try. You know, just give me a couple of old hypervisors in the data center and let me try this out. And let's start using just the Terraform modules that we normally use to deploy EC2 instances and deploy stuff in our own data center. It'd be awesome.
Mm-hmm. It'd be fun because you'd hit all the weird edge cases with, you know, the network integration and that kind of thing. But if you could shoehorn it all in there, it'd be pretty neat. That's cool.
Well, and if you were saying to yourself, well, that's great, but I need to run that on Red Hat Enterprise Linux, which I couldn't do. I now have the announcement that says you can. So EKS Anywhere now supports Red Hat Enterprise Linux on EKS Anywhere, joining Bottle Rocket and Ubuntu. So you have a broader choice of OS to create and operate your EKS Anywhere cluster in your on-premise data center or other cloud provider. Red Hat Enterprise Linux supports EKS Anywhere on vSphere, Bare Metal, and guess what? Apache Cloud Stack. So there you go.
Yeah, you want a supported OS, right? So I think there's some compliance things that people use Red Hat and the associated satellite service to sort of verify, you know, as a compliance control step.
Well, I mean, a lot of companies, they've chosen either Canonical or they've chosen Red Hat as their enterprise Linux of choice. And so when you don't support Red Hat, it sort of limits your ability to use the service. So, the fact that they didn't have this right away was kind of a surprise to me because I think on the Bare Metal, they deploy Amazon Linux. But it's nice to have this option.
My spidey sense is tingling. I'm wondering if this is if this partnership with CloudStack is going to be relevant to something at reInvent. I'm putting a pin in that.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to dark mode, just in time for Halloween. Channel your inner goth self. The AWS console now supports dark mode, and you can find this in your settings menu. You can specify your console to be light, dark, or follow your web browser's lead. Benefits of dark mode include improved navigation across interfaces and apparently reduced energy usage on some devices, which, what devices are those? Like nuclear monitors? one nice thing, it follows you to other devices and browsers, but it is tied to the account. So if you have lots of accounts, this will be you have to set this for each and every one of them. And I'm hoping someone hacks together a Chrome plugin to just automatically do this for you in the background so I don't have to do it. Because I don't want to go to every one of my Amazon accounts and set this setting.
I always find it funny their choices of what's stored in the session or stored as an account setting. Like I can't manage authentication to save my life across Amazon consoles. But, you know, dark mode, yeah, no, that's separate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they finally announced just recently, and they haven't posted a blog post, so we haven't talked about it as a new thing, but they just recently actually said they're going to finally segment out the Amazon.com from AWS authentication model. So you no longer have Amazon.com store access with your AWS account and vice versa, which I've been asking for. I think I added a feature request to Jeff Barr about that many, many, many years ago. So good to see. All right. In a feature you will never be able to use on Windows, or I'd like to see you try it. You can now replace the root volume of an instance using an updated AMI without requiring customers to stop their instance. This allows customers to easily update their applications and guest operating system or retaining the instance stored data, networking, and IAM configuration. Customers can use this feature to patch their software quickly without having to incur the operational cost of instance stored data backups or replication. And customers with stateful workloads can use this feature to ensure that their software is up to date and improve security posture by patching more frequently. So that would be voodoo magic if you do that on Windows. I assume it's something I can do on Linux pretty easily. It does say in the blog post, though, that they do the reboot for you automatically. So the whole doesn't stop your server is sort of a lie.
Well, it doesn't stop it in that you don't lose your instance store where you
always... Yeah, so they don't terminate it, basically, is what they're saying. Yeah.
That's like an in-place swap of the OS. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's a clever idea and makes sense versus, you know, doing a snapshot of your local storage and restoring it onto a new VM, which takes a lot of time and all the other things they've done to make warm boots faster.
And I'd much rather orchestrate, you know, this swap out of the volumes than a hellacious like Ansible playbook to go log in, download an update, do all the things and verify health. So
fair enough. So Amazon Aurora now supports cluster export to S3 without using a snapshot. So you could do this before, but you had to create a snapshot, and then the snapshot would export to S3. You end up paying for the snapshot, and you might forget about it and pay for it forever. But now it can export natively directly to S3 in Apache Parquet format without creating that snapshot. Customers can also initiate an export to S3 directly from the Aurora database cluster, saving them time, cost, and extra overhead of creating and retaining snapshots of exports to S3. Exporting data to S3 from an Aurora cluster does not impact the performance of the Aurora database, and the export data in Apache Parquet format is portable, so customers can analyze their data with query services such as Amazon Athena or big data processing frameworks such as Apache Spark, or, you know, hey, Google BigQuery if you're in that ecosystem too.
Ever.
Well, you can plug in S3 as a data set to BigQuery, right? Yeah, so this is a nice feature. It's, you know, I think it's just completing the workflow they already had and sort of in the back end with that snapshot. But it's a great way to maintain a large data set and save money when you're not actively querying it. So very cool.
Have you been waiting months and months to hire your new AWS, GCP, or Azure architect only to have them be poached at the 11th hour by a startup with a juice bar? Initiative stalled because you're having trouble hiring? Well, I have a simple solution. Foghorn Consulting. Foghorn Consulting provides top-notch cloud engineers to the world's most innovative companies and can be burning down your DevOps and cloud backlogs as soon as next week. Foghorn certified AWS, GCP, and Azure professionals are armed with infrastructure as code, and from day one will be designing performant, optimized cloud-native or hybrid environments that deliver on the promise of cloud. Their FogOps solution even provides on-demand cloud engineering to augment your existing teams. Visit www.foghornconsulting.com or send an email to cloudtalentnow@foghornconsulting.com and tell them the CloudPod sent you. Your dedicated FogOps team is with you for the long haul, and they bring their own juice.
Amazon MSK now offers a new low-cost storage tier that scales up virtually unlimited storage. MSK now offers a tiered storage that brings that unlimited storage to you. Tiered storage lets you store and process more data using the same Kafka API and clients, which saves you your storage costs by 50% or more over existing MSK storage options. Tiered storage makes it easy and cost-effective when you need a long safety buffer to handle unexpected processing delays or build new streams processing applications. You can now scale out your compute and storage independently, simplifying your operations. You can also enable tiered storage with a few clicks for new and existing clusters and pay only for the storage and data retrieval you care about. Which, I like this because I like the flexibility. I also don't want any of my architects to ever know this exists because they'll just store the messages in the bus forever.
That's, yeah. Like, I'm like, oh, people are going to abuse this. I'll abuse this. Yeah. But it is nice. And I'm sure it's going to save someone because this is one of those things where you can really paint yourself into a danger zone with Kafka.
So. Yeah. You're going to trade money for downtime, I think, with something like this.
Data loss, which is usually something you're willing to pay for.
Can't wait for the performance team to fill up the disk on Kafka again.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be nice too. Like, I mean, there's definitely advantages, but again, like, you know, you can abuse Kafka in horrendous, horrendous ways. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's move on to GCP. Assured workloads have come to Australia and Canada, eh? Assured workload is Google's investment in ensuring your workloads are created and maintained, controlled to enforce data residency, administrative and personnel controls, and manage your encryption keys. In addition to those new regions, there are also some new features available to you, including the fact that assured workload monitoring is now generally available, which allows you more visibility into organizational policy changes that result in compliance violations. Assured workload monitoring scans customer environments in real time and provides alerts whenever a change violates the defined compliance posture. You can also now create a FedRAMP moderate workload through self-service onboarding through assured workloads with no additional charges, which is great because it was pretty expensive to set up FedRAMP environments previously.
I'm sure this is going to help a lot of people. I just don't think I'm going to be one of them. I just see complexity and difficult environments.
I got nothing really. Just
it's fine.
Like having an alert on changes. Well, I guess use policies to make things not change that you don't want to change.
All right. Well, Google is announcing Google's Cloud Blockchain Node Engine. Managing your own blockchain nodes is difficult to deploy and requires constant management, apparently. Blockchain Node Engine is a new fully managed node hosting service that can minimize the need for node operations. And Web3 companies who require dedicated nodes can relay transactions, deploy smart contracts, and read or write blockchain data with reliability, performance, and security they expect from Google. Ethereum is the first blockchain supported by the Blockchain Node Engine, enabling developers to provide fully managed Ethereum nodes with secure blockchain access. You get streamlined provisioning, secure development, and fully managed operations. Now, I have to ask you guys, aren't most Web3 companies not using Ethereum? Aren't most of them trying to create their own magical NFTs or or other crazy, you know, currencies in blockchain? Like, do they care about this announcement because they're announcing Ethereum? Like, that seems a bit of a miss on the first release.
I mean, I think that, you know, the reason why the constant management and the maintenance of these things becomes, you know, such a burden for these companies is because they'd much rather spend their time talking about what they're going to do with Web3, and just it's like the new CrossFit. So, like, I don't know that they're going to spend any time doing this otherwise. So, makes sense. Which Bitcoin engine blockchain engine they use, I don't know.
Oh, you're a blockchain expert, Jonathan. What do you think? Mm-hmm. He's like, don't paint me with that brush. I never said that. Never claimed it. How dare you, Dustin? That's true. You've never said that. I just was making fun of
it. He hasn't called me bro once, so I don't know.
I mean, one of the core ideas of Web3 is just being able to decentralize a lot of things which have become very centralized, whether it's identity or ownership or finance. But Ethereum is popular, has a good ecosystem. It's designed for contract enforcement, things like this. I probably wouldn't. I mean, I don't know, I guess they have to lead with something which is easy to use and popular. But
Ethereum one of the most like efficient ones as well, as far as like, you know, impact, energy impact?
You mean from a total like green impact?
It is now, because they moved away from proof of work to proof of stake. So you need cash to run a node, and you get paid effectively interest on the investment you make in Ethereum to run the node, instead of crunching through, you know, billions of hashes a day to try and find a magic number. So, and it's probably, I mean, in terms of, you know, the environmental aspect of it, this is probably the best blockchain they could have gone with, without being sort of criticized for being anti-nature.
No one wants to be anti-nature. That's never good in these days.
No. I mean, it seems pretty obvious now that there's much less money to be made in Ethereum mining. The value has dropped to, you know, a quarter of what it was at its peak. And so, I mean, we kind of got to wonder if it's all just a big circle jerk.
Well, I was wondering, with the incoming recession, how many Web 3.0 companies survive this, the upcoming bloodbath. And, you know, NFTs have completely fallen off the market. Blockchain is not doing great. Many of the cryptocurrencies are down significantly year to date. So, how many of these Web 3 companies survive long term? And, you know, again, going back to the bro comment, so many of them are just bros who are just, you know, quick pump and dump schemes anyway. So, like, it's going to be interesting to see which ones do survive, if any. And if they do survive, it's probably because they actually have something that I care about. And I'm curious what those are. So we'll see. Maybe it's a recession can flush out some of this Web3 noise and nonsense. Well, this is a weird one for me. So Google Cloud and HashiCorp are going to deliver a more efficient approach for cloud support services. Now, neither one of these companies is known for their rock solid enterprise grade support. So that's going to be interesting. But after apparently receiving a lot of feedback, Google Cloud and HashiCorp have engaged in a joint collaboration with a focus to develop a more effective support model for customers who subscribe to both Google Cloud and HashiCorp products. This innovative approach enables Google Cloud Premium support customers and HashiCorp Terraform customers to benefit from a seamless support process which answers the who, where, when, and how for technical issues related to Terraform and Google. There's a quote here from Burzin Patel, HashiCorp's VP of Global Partner Alliances. Google Cloud is an important partner to HashiCorp, and our enterprise customers use HashiCorp Terraform and Google Cloud to deploy mission-critical infrastructure at scale. With 70 million downloads of Terraform Google provider this year and growing, we're excited to collaborate closely with Google Cloud to offer our joint customers a seamless experience, which we will believe will significantly enhance their experience on the Google Cloud. With this normal support approach, customers of Google Cloud or HashiCorp support gain the option to submit a support case with either organization, With each case submission, the customer sees the best timed resolution as both organizations can help resolve the case together.
Yeah, that's not normally how it works, but okay.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, that's how they point fingers.
So wait, this is going to increase or decrease the finger pointing?
I think this is an admission from Terraform that they can't actually help you with the Google Cloud provider that they produce and host on their website that gets part of their product, because Google is actually writing the Terraform provider. And so by now making them link together, when there's a Terraform Google provider issue, HashiCorp can just say, this is not our problem, talk to them instead.
Yeah, not only is Google writing it, but they're writing it with, you know, automation and AI. So it's sort of writing itself. And it shows.
Yeah, you can kind of see how this came about. It's kind of like, you're making us look bad. And they're like, no, you're making us look bad.
And in reality, it's both of you making each other look bad, but yeah. You can now jointly blame each other together. So.
Yeah, maybe I should use Amazon Connect instead. They could work on these complicated cases together.
Oh, that's right. They should. They should definitely use Amazon Connect. It'll help them out tremendously. Well, Google operates, of course, in the shared fate model, which is very similar to the dual fates, working in concert with their customers to help achieve stronger security outcomes. One of the ways they do this is identify potentially risky behavior to help customers determine if actions is appropriate. Google is now providing you insights on what we are called, or they are calling, sensitive actions. Sensitive actions are focused on understanding IAM account or user account behavior, and they track changes made in Google Cloud that are security relevant and therefore important to be aware of and evaluate, because they may be a precursor to an attack or make other attacks possible or part of an effort to monetize your account with Bitcoin mining. When a sensitive action is detected, it will appear in two places: the Security Command Center Premium, if you're paying for it, as the primary source, but also available in Cloud Logging, where Google recommends you integrate it into monitoring workflows like a SIEM. Some of the interesting things that I'll take a look at for you here, sensitive actions. First up, organizational policy has changed. That's okay. Remove your billing admin from the account. Yeah, that seems like it'd be bad. GPU instance created. Yep, for that blockchain. Many instances created or many instances deleted, or adding sensitive roles or project SSH keys added for a project that is more than 10 days old. So they assume that if you apparently have a project that's been more than 10 days, you don't have to create new SSH keys. And so that's a precursor to an attack. So there you go.
Does it do that kind of analysis where you're like doing both two different components? Because it's one thing to just tag basically the actions, but if it's saying that this action 10 days later is risky, that's pretty cool.
I mean, they're definitely got to be using multiple things, right? Because they're saying they're using ML and AI. So, I mean, like, if every access to the account admin console comes from these IP addresses, it's probably less risky than if that came from an IP address you haven't seen before that all of a sudden created an SSH key in a project. You know, so I assume that it gets some ML intelligence, you know, unless it's just regex, which I won't put past that either. I assume that there's some level of ML thought process that goes into it, but they don't really get specifics about how they it out.
I mean, the example they've included in the blog post was, it seemed very simple to me, which is like, you know, removing an organizational policy or removing a contact or, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just like, I thought it was like, ooh, tagging for their cloud logs. Cool.
Yeah. I wonder if it really is just the cloud audit trail sort of process through a ML model looking for weird behaviors.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it is, but it depends on, is it generating an event based on multiple factors, or is it just saying, oh, someone has made this change alert?
Created a GPU instance and it's my ML account. I don't need a SOC person coming and going, hey, why did you create a GPU instance? And like, because I'm doing ML training, and they're like, you need to justify that with the CISO. Like, no, I don't want to do that. Yeah. Like, it's my job. I'm supposed to be doing that. But again, if it's some third party IP address that's never accessed my account before and they're creating, you know, 20 GPU instances, I'd like you to flag that. So again, it has to have something, but maybe in the preview, it doesn't have a lot of smarts yet. We'll see.
Yeah. It's hard to say. Even from reading the docs, it's hard to tell exactly what.
Yeah. Light on details of this one. Like, there was more questions than answers in this blog post. Sure.
I mean, I guess it's kind of like a SIEM for your cloud API in a way. It's not a SIEM for your application or your data. It's a SIEM for the actions that you're doing using the APIs.
Well, I'd expect a SIEM to be a little bit more, you know, in depth, not just logging these actions. And if it finds something of, you know, like an organization query, or the best example is a whole bunch of instances were deployed. And it triggers an alert like that. You don't want that kind of noise being generated every deployment, right? So that's sort of one of those things where I'm just like, as long as there's some sort of evaluation, then it doesn't really explain it very well.
So Google's going to be hosting a BI hackathon, or business intelligence, for those who don't know what BI means, where application developers, innovators, and data scientists can collaborate and build new innovative applications, tools, and data experiences using Looker and Looker Studio. This is a two-day virtual event starting on December 6th, and Google has four reasons you should consider joining. First of all, is meet and team up with your developer community and Google Cloud innovators. Gain hands-on experience and learn about Looker and Looker Studio's latest features. Meet and talk to Looker and Looker Studio engineers and staff and play some trivia, apparently, and turn your idea into reality and have fun along the way. So if you're into hackathons and you've got a dead week, that first week of December, you can go spend some time on the hackathon. I think technically that is a Tuesday, Wednesday. So there you go. I see you guys signing to the sign up. Yeah, you guys are running there.
No, I mean, this has become my every day. I just do this hackathon all day long now.
Yeah.
With my own data set. So yeah.
which is the more fun way, you know. But if you have some new brilliant thing you want to create for business intelligence, you know, there's a hackathon for you.
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, Scaffold V2 is finally generally available. Of course, the original Scaffold was announced in 2019 as generally available, which was a command line tool that facilitates continuous development and delivery for containerized apps. Now with V2, you get expanded capabilities, including more supported platforms and architectures with the introduction of Cloud Run and support for building ARM and x86 architectures. Scaffold V2 also enhances support for CI/CD and GitOps. And best of all, it's fully compatible with Scaffold V1. And by fully compatible, it means you need to run Scaffold Fix and it'll update it for you. So it's not backwards compatible. It's just compatible so you don't have to rewrite the code. So you're welcome.
Yeah. I'll take that. If you make it easy for me to update forward, I'm generally okay with that. It's still just a little bit disruptive, but
Can someone send this to HashiCorp?
Yeah. To be fair, they did actually have a lot of code to upgrade your Terraform code when they were going through the every 6 weeks release.
Yeah, but like sometimes they did and sometimes it didn't quite work the way you wanted it to. It wasn't as clean as I'd like it to be. Let's just put it that way.
Oh, I suspect that Scaffold Fix has got the same.
I'm sure it does. It's probably not as great as I hope it is.
They're already at V2, so it's way past HashiCorp time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if it was HashiCorp, it'd still be version.3. So.
Yeah.
All right, let's move to Azure. The standard monthly update for cost management is here once again, and we don't really talk about it because it really just covers things like new labs and new ways to save money and new documentation and new videos. And, you know, if you're a cost person, you should really care. But I don't really care that much about what they talk about most of the time. But this time in there, as I was skimming through it to see if there's something worthwhile, there was. And that was the Azure service plans are now available. Azure Savings Plans is a new pricing offering that gives customers easy and flexible ways to save up to 65% on compute costs compared to pay-as-you-go pricing, in addition to the existing offers and marketing, including Azure Hybrid Benefits. Azure saving plans lower costs on select Azure services with a commitment to spend a fixed hourly amount for 1 to 3 years. You choose whether to pay all up front or monthly at no extra cost. And as you use services such as VM and container instances across the world, their usage is covered by the plan at reduced prices, helping you get more value for your cloud budget, which, good God, man, just say it's savings plans for AWS, but on Azure. Like, why did you have to go through all those words? Azure savings plans are available on VMs, app services, Azure Functions Premium, container instances, and dedicated hosts. Now, meaning that all three cloud providers have now shamelessly stolen AWS's idea, as FlexCuds were also generally available at Google Cloud Next, which is Google's answer to savings plans. And now Microsoft has them as well. And they couldn't have been bothered to talk about it at Ignite. So what does that say about it?
I mean, you know, you'd think with all the announcements coming out of Azure lately, which there aren't any, that they wouldn't have had to bury this in this, you know, overall like October sum up. I really don't understand it because this is, you know, extremely useful for managing cloud workloads and trying to squeeze out all the value that you possibly can while also, you know, paying someone else to run your servers.
It works like AWS too, in that you get a discount on the compute, but you don't get a discount on any of the supporting software. So if you're running SQL Server, you don't get the discount on that part of the license. No surprise. I think there would be lawsuits through the roof if Azure started giving discounts on that kind of license.
Agreed. And then apparently Azure Cosmos DB now offers a built-in role-based access control capability, or RBAC, that allows you to authorize your data requests with a fine-grained role-based permission model. Users and roles residing within your database can be managed using the Azure CLI, Azure PowerShell, or Azure Resource Manager.
Interesting timing on the release of this, you know, like with all the security vulnerabilities and issues with Cosmos earlier. I wonder if this is related to that.
Yeah, I'm just putting a control in place right now. Deny, whiz, all.
And that is it for new news this week. And time to go to the self-paced lightning round. Jonathan, I gave you the short straw this week, so you have to start us off. Our unscored lightning round.
Unscored. That's just, we could vote on it. Well, let's see how we do first. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Amazon Cognito now provides user pool deletion protection.
Which does make me mad when I get mad at Cognito. Next time I try to use it again, that I can't delete anything because I turned this on. Because I'll just be deleting it, moving to Okta immediately or Auth0. The
best way to enforce, you know, access to your applications is by deleting the whole user pool. Can't get in now.
Mm-hmm. AWS Nitro Enclaves is now supported on AWS Graviton. These transformers just aren't as cool as the old ones were.
Yeah. Transform into a pocket protector. AWS Service Manager Connector now streamlines display of AWS Service Catalog products. I almost made it. By account and region in ServiceNow Service Portal.
I just wanted to hear you say service.
Yeah. Like 9,000 times. Yeah.
I think they could put it service in there a few more times, but yeah. If they signed a partnership with ServiceNow to service the serviceness of the portal, yeah, that'd be good too. So yeah, all kinds of options.
Is this a service manager for my connector service?
And then plus I also had the fact that this is a service catalog, which I know is your favorite thing in the whole world. So like there was multiple jokes here that I just, you know, wrote themselves by giving you this one.
Okay. And, you know, like, yeah, so they're pumping the AWS service catalog into the service catalog that is ServiceNow. Like, oh my God.
It's just service catalogs all the way down, man. It's a service catalog. Yeah.
You know, a customer requested this and I want to know who hurt them.
It was probably ServiceNow.
Yeah, fair enough.
Moving on, please. Amazon SES now offers new model to simplify provisioning and managing dedicated IPs.
Because everyone needs to have more ways to send IP, you know, emails out via IP addresses. Great, thanks.
Yeah, no, I mean, how else am I going to get, like, you know, millions and millions of junk mails except for, you know, the one source that I think is safe on the internet? So I've given that a very specific rule, therefore removing any kind of failure tolerance. And this is genius.
Brilliant.
At least it's easier to manage now.
Yeah. If you don't bring your own IPs and use them at SES, I think you're pretty much lost anyway at this point. Somebody has tarnished the reputation of that IP that you've been given.
Yeah.
You literally find yourself having to send spam just to gain a good reputation.
I mean, when do you think mail servers will have to start supporting IPv6 because all IPv4 IP addresses are so tainted in reputation that, you know, they're all screwed? Announcing new AWS Amplify library for Swift, now with support for both iOS and macOS. Now with support, it was built for it.
Wait a second. What did it do before? Announcing Red Hat Enterprise Linux workstations on AWS.
I mean, Ubuntu, Red Hat, someone really thinks this is the year of the Linux desktop. Mm-hmm. It's only been the year of the Linux desktop since 2001. So, you know, Linux Mandrake.
Can't make everyone VPN, but you can give them all VDIs.
I had to think about that. Like, would I be mad about having a Linux workstation or a Windows workstation as my VDI? Like, both are not optimal experiences for my workflow. Like, which one would make me more cranky? Probably Windows. But, you know, dealing with Linux desktop is also would make me cranky. I'd just be like, just give me a server console. Just give me an SSH console, please. I'll just work with that.
Yeah. Open Chrome. Open a terminal. And you're set, really, honestly, at this point, regardless of whether you've got a Mac, a Linux machine, or Windows anymore.
I mean, I don't know. I want it because of all the, like, the underlying, like, nerd stuff you can do with, like, cron and that kind of thing. Like, I love having a development workstation that runs Linux.
and doesn't have a bunch of management tools installed on it.
Well, I mean, that's going to be on this one. You know, it's a managed workstation, no matter which way you slice it.
Amazon RDS now supports events for operating system updates. Like, come party with us.
Yeah. Hey, so you know why your database slowed down? You do now.
Yeah. I was thinking, I mean, the event that the operating system rebooted underneath the RDS database, I mean, it seems like a pretty clear event that occurred. So, you know, I'm glad it now supports those in a more, you know, famous way.
Oh, I thought it meant like you're going to invite a DJ and have a big party or something, I guess. Wrong kind of event. Finally, we've updated SQL 2012.
Woo! 2012, 2008, man. No. Amazon Virtual Private Cloud now supports the transfer of elastic IP addresses between AWS accounts, which I return you to Jonathan's. Amazon SES now offers new model support for provisioning and managing dedicated IP addresses. You now can move those non-tarnished IP addresses to the right account to then tarnish them. So you're welcome.
How many companies do you think have that like one historic old legacy account, but it's got like all the stuff?
I just think about all the companies who didn't get the memo. You're supposed to do a multi-account strategy, who created this big massive account and then ran into major quota issues. And then now they're stuck with this one account that has the load balancer with IP they need because they can't move it to any. Yeah, this is for them.
Yeah.
Someone's got that IP whitelisted for their FTP server.
Yeah. Or their email server, turns out. AWS CloudTrail Lake now supports export of signed query results to Amazon S3.
When did CloudTrail Lake become a thing? Like, I like that they just call it a lake now because that's what everyone has to do with their CloudTrail logs, because it's too much data. You have to dump it into a data lake to get any value out of it. But now they just call it that? It's well done.
Is it not a separate product?
I mean, it might be. I don't remember this being announced, though. So I'm just going to call it. That's what everyone does. It's a CloudTrail Lake. It makes sense.
I had in mind this, like, you know, golden record with CloudTrail events written on it, and somebody had actually signed it and put it up on the wall. Like, this is when we get this. This was the famous hack of 2022.
Yeah,
that'd be kind of cool.
Improve your Azure SQL managed instance. Well, let me start that again. Improve your Azure SQL managed instance performance with new TempDB configurations.
Is this like so I can have multiple TempDBs? Like what? Like what's my what configuration could possibly improve my performance that much?
Like, we've tried 59,000 configurations. Let's just try one more.
Auto scale compute to higher limits with up to 80 vCores in selected regions using Azure SQL Database serverless.
So now I'll be able to assign all those vCores to my new TempDBs. Sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Servers, serverless servers with 80 vCores. Yeah, that's an oxymoron.
I think they don't understand what serverless means.
I mean, that whole Neptune story earlier, I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, I don't think serverless doesn't mean auto-scaling. Serverless means something different, like eventing, right? Like, apparently not in the world anymore. We've now broadened the term serverless to be anything that's managed for you. Right. Well, do you guys want to vote on who won that? Or was it all so pathetic?
Oh, could you just pick one winner? Oh, I don't know. It'd be hard.
Well, let's give us all a point by subtracting one from Peter for not showing up.
There you go. I like it. 0 points, Peter. Perfect. I think Matt was the one who gave Peter that point, and then I was still questioning the logic at the time. But yeah,
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So now we've righted the wrong that was occurred many, many months ago. Okay. Well, there's only one thing coming up that matters, and that's reInvent, November 28th through December 2nd. And unless my list is empty, other than that BI thing, which I won't ever mention again because I'll forget about it. But that's what's coming up. And if you're heading to reInvent soon, we'll talk about our reInvent tips and tricks here in the next couple of weeks, as well as do our prediction show for what we think AWS is going to do at reInvent, which we're all going to be wrong because we're all really unplugged from the AWS ecosystem at this point. So we will we'll see.
Or are we going to be right for the first time ever? Because being plugged in
didn't help
us previously. Yeah.
I mean, I definitely could not have predicted how boring Google Next was. Like, I mean,
oh my god.
So that's it for another fantastic week here in the cloud. Have a good night, guys.
See you later.
Bye, everybody.
And that is the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting.
subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions.
All right, well, we got to talk about DHH. And for those of you who know who that is, he is the founder of Ruby on Rails, David Heinemeier Hansen. He's a bit of a polarizing figure in tech, for those of you who know of him. You know, he is the founder and CTO, I think, at Basecamp, one of the founders. He's behind Hey.com, which was an email client that everyone was really excited about 2 years ago, and now no one ever talks about anymore. And I don't see that many Hey.com email addresses, so I don't actually know how well that product's doing. But apparently, he's come around and said that they've been running extensively in both Amazon and Google Cloud, and they run on bare virtual machines running on Kubernetes. And they've seen all the cloud has to offer and tried most of it, and finally come to the conclusion that renting computers is mostly a bad deal for medium-sized companies like theirs with stable growth. And the savings promise and reduced complexity never materialized for them. And so they're making their plans to vacate the cloud and go back on-premise. So he basically goes on to argue about there's two types of companies that can do well with this. We're not one of them. Predictability means that the cloud is more expensive. And he talked about he waxed poetically about Heroku and how Heroku is amazing for certain types of companies. But overall, they're basically saying they think they're experts in running Kubernetes on bare metal, and so they should move it on-premise. They've been spending about $500,000 per year for databases and search through Elasticsearch on Amazon. And they've been processing emails through that system for a long time, but lots of money, and they're tired of spending it on cloud. What do you guys think?
I mean, I wouldn't have picked Elasticsearch on Amazon. That is not a cheap service. But yeah, I completely agree with what he's saying. Move to the cloud, flexibility during development, scale to where you need, figure out how you scale and what you need to do. And then when it makes sense, go do it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, if you have a very predictable workload, I would agree with his consensus that you probably aren't saving a lot of money on cloud. But I the fact that they're not getting a value out of cloud native services, I mean, they're using servers and databases and Elasticsearch. Like, that's not a lot of cloud native technology, if any. And there's, again, the beauty of cloud is not around making servers, data centers in the cloud work better. It's about taking new patterns that give you high availability and service redundancy and availability across multiple regions with low levels of friction to do that. Versus now you have to do that in Hey.com's case, like if they need to get into European privacy laws, now do they have to have a data center in Europe? Like, do they want to spend that kind of capital now to expand into Europe, into Asia, into other countries where data sovereignty is? And like, does that make sense for them long-term? Versus leveraging, AWS or Google, where they have multiple global regions, they can deploy anywhere they need to for customer compliance reasons. Like, there's all kinds of options for them that they don't get when they move right for this. And so it's one of those, like, yeah, you might be saving money in the short term, but you're losing opportunity. And then how many people, like, Ryan, would you like to go take a job where you're full-time working on Kubernetes on bare metal?
Or managing Elasticsearch ever again?
No. Yeah.
I'd rather claw out my eyes with a spoon.
Yeah, both of those sound horrendously awful. And then, do they take OpenSearch with them or do they go to Elasticsearch?
Right.
Then they're going to pay Elasticsearch bajillions of dollars in licensing they weren't paying before. Just get away from more Amazon stuff with OpenSearch. Like, there's so many questions I have about this kind of thing.
I mean, I think he makes some really good points about, the sales job of the cloud, because I think that it really is sold to people. Like, if you move to the cloud, it's just going to be cheaper. And I don't think the story is fleshed out beforehand until you get into that environment. You realize that, yeah, if you re-architect your application and take advantage of auto scaling, if you, if you really work diligently on keeping your environments clean and only what you need, can you actually save money on it? And so, like, yeah, if you're just going to, recklessly send data into an Elasticsearch cluster, it may as well be your own, because, that is going to be the only way you can make that somewhat cheaper, is by, just basically commoditizing and throwing your own employees under the bus from having to manage that. At least you can get a discount on scale. Like, I just, I think all these are not great examples for the good points that he's throwing in there.
I think cheaper means different things to different people. And it certainly means different things at different times in organizations' growth. I mean, if you're a startup and you've got not a lot of capital. You don't want to go away and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on servers, and renting month to month or hour to hour in the cloud makes an enormous amount of sense. Mm-hmm. And on the other end of the scale, even with, you know, 45-50% discounts on compute with 3-year commitments and things, does that make sense for a company whose revenue stream is probably fairly unpredictable? I mean, people will pull out of Haydock. It's $100 a month for a Haydock email address.
Is it really $100 a month?
Sorry, yeah, I lie.
Okay. I'm in the wrong business.
Yeah, no. $100 a year, which is reasonable, and I have a Haydock account.
I had a trial that I never paid for it because I was like, I don't want to move all my mail from Google to this. So.
Same.
Yeah, but I mean, small businesses aren't going to get the benefit of capital expense versus operational expense that larger companies will. So I don't know. I guess it just depends where you are in the ecosystem. And
well, I mean, to get the like for like service too. Like that's always the hardest part for me to justify, because just as someone who doesn't really want to spend a lot of time operating instances, like what I don't want to go back to is the days of, you know, waiting weeks for, you know, network paths to be established and infrastructure to become available, and then the back and forth of, you know, system administration to get access to these things. And like, so you're really talking about investment of a bunch of management applications on top of just the rented servers that, you know, that you are paying for. And so I think it does a disservice to sort of ignore that, like the quality of running on these servers is much better than if you're just managing compute in a data center raw.
I guess if you've reached a point where you're no longer innovating, or if all your apps are going to run in the same stack, then you build it once and you just use it. So why keep paying that tax when you don't have to?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you think part of the problem is that all of these apps are built on Ruby on Rails, which is horrendously bad at scaling.
It's probably not a good start, right? Like,
yeah. You know, it's sort of interesting, you know, because he goes into, like, you know, the story about, you know, that sure, you have to manage these machines. The cloud is so much simpler. The savings will be there in labor costs. Except no, anyone who thinks running a major service like Hay or Basecamp in the cloud is simple has clearly never tried. And I agree with him. The cloud is complex. It's not easy. But he also could go to DigitalOcean. He could go to Linode. He could go to, you know, any of the major cloud providers that are out there and probably negotiate deals and terms and things like that to get that to be more cost effective. But, you know, I'm curious if actually in the long term it comes out to be cheaper for him, because right now he's not even understanding what he truly is getting from the cloud, because he's using, you know, a lot of bare metal services and he's getting some advantage from them, but he's not taking care of that stuff. But now he's got to go deal with data centers. He's got to go do colo. He's got to negotiate. He's got to deal with ordering hardware, which is a really bad time to buy hardware with their supply chain, and then managing that stuff. And is it going to help them long term or not? I think it's a question. So it'd be curious if he updates this in a few years, if he realizes that he was mistaken in that he didn't actually get a benefit. Because I think what I've seen in other cases is, yeah, there's a group of people who were working on your infrastructure who don't have a job anymore, who have transitioned to the cloud. And then you can now manage the cloud with those same people. And yes, it's complex, but you get so much more value and so much more scale for those cloud resources and those people, because they can manage so many more boxes than when you deal with the physical asset side of it. So I'm curious if it actually, he sees it as like, well, I don't have that many people and it's super complicated, but if I make it simple and I put it on Kubernetes on bare metal in my data center, I'll be able to do the exact same thing I can do with the people I have managing cloud. I don't know if that's true. I think that's an interesting question. I think he ends up needing more people because of, again, if you're geo-locating people, you're flying more people around, you're needing to, you know, care and feed hardware that you're not care and feeding today. Even though you're using bare metal, you know, Amazon's still taking care of your server when it dies or when it has a hard drive problem or other cooling and power issues. And they're getting a much more commodity price for storage and cooling because they own the data center. They own the power to the data center. They own the telco. Whereas I go to a colo, I'm paying them for power. I'm paying for telco from different providers. Like, there's all these costs that get factored into data center. I think there is a point where it does make sense. Like Backblaze, we talked about a little earlier in the show. Their business is predicated on massive amounts of storage, and they've done the math and it makes sense for them to run it on their own storage and their own data center and their own custom hardware. And it's a very unique specialty business that they understand, and they understand it really well. You know, all it takes in Hey or Basecamp's case is they write a bad feature and now they went from needing 12 servers to needing 100 servers because of a bad feature, and now they're having a service outage. Now they can code up, they can code that feature back out. Sure, you know, they can turn it off and not have that problem, but they still have bigger impact where, you know, at least they could have hidden that away in an auto-scaling kind of situation with the cloud. So there's pluses and minuses to all of these things.
I want to mention Jeremy Daly's parody blog post, though, that he made. Jeremy Daly, GM Serverless Cloud, AWS Serverless Hero, made a parody post talking about why we're leaving the electric grid. And, you know, I kind of get it. It's kind of funny. It seems like it might take, you know, what Basecamp's doing to the extreme. But on the other hand, if you're in business to make money, and if you can run it, and if you can run power generation, and you can do it significantly cheaper than what you can buy from PG&E or whichever power company you have around, why wouldn't you do it? I mean, data centers are building solar panels on the roof. How is that not leaving the electric grid to some extent? You know, they're putting up wind turbines. They're putting huge amounts of support into green energy. That's basically what he's saying here. People are leaving the electric grid because it's too expensive. It's bad for the environment, and they're making huge efforts to to reduce their costs and be better environmentalists. So
I think that I would agree with this blog post if it was just saying that, though, because he's not. Like that is the underlying theme here, but the reasons he's using to argue that point, that, you know, he can do it cheaper by doing it himself, or there's a lot of falsities and a lot of things that he's sort of glossing over.
Well, and the reality is there are businesses that consume massive amounts of electricity that in their particular scenario, they may actually be better off generating their own power. And this is actually one of the areas the Melinda and Bill Gates Foundation has invested in, is, you know, small scale nuclear reactors for manufacturing facilities and for environments where you need a high amount of power, and basically the unit gets buried in the ground and it's self-contained and it doesn't need a lot of management. There are some scenarios. So it is sort of, you know, while I get what he's doing from a parody perspective, it does sort of miss the mark that is actually a problem that some companies have. Or even look at Disney World, they generate their own electricity. you know, they have their own power plants on the property as well as, you know, they do also rely on the grid as well. So they have ability to handle spike needs, which is actually an argument for hybrid cloud, which they didn't even talk about in this argument. But, you know, there's also that side of the DHH story too, where, you know, he could go hybrid and take advantage of both, you know, on-prem for high cost components that, you know, are really predictable, and then use cloud for other things, but you know, you don't want to buy a WAF, just use Amazon's or just use Google's and point it to your on-prem stuff. Like, that's a choice.
Well, I guarantee you that 37 Signals has, you know, an account either on Google or Amazon or Azure for just that. Like, guarantee it.
Or they leverage Cloudflare, or they leverage some other provider for it. But yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, no, it was a good attempt. I sort of chuckled at it more from the, you know, just the ridiculousness of the article. But then, yeah, when you really start thinking about what he said, it's like, yeah, it doesn't really hold water. You know, and again, there are usages where you see, like, solar panels, a good example too, where, you know, people are moving to a process where they do better in their own thing. Now, the sustainability side of the DHH article is interesting too, because if sustainability becomes a really key value prop to a company and your ability to be green and show your customers that you're doing green things, can he be as green as you need to be effective with a data center running Basecamp for an enterprise that cares about sustainability?
Who knows? They have APIs for that nowadays.
Yeah, interesting. We are definitely going to see, I think, a lot of companies with these type of blog posts with the recession pending, basically saying, hey, it doesn't make sense for us to be in the cloud and pay a 20 or 30% premium. We're not getting the value in a cost-cutting mode right now. It makes sense for us to invest in our own data center for this purpose. I think there will be stories like that during the recession. I just think it's a natural part of this evolution. I still think the right answer is hybrid, even for those companies, but we'll see where it goes. You know, it'll be some, you know, that's maybe why you're seeing some growth slowdown in Google and Azure and AWS. So, you know, the earnings will say what's happening in the market.
Yeah.
Bottom line is always do what's best for the business. Simple as that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to be said for focusing on your core business, you know, strengths and leaving power generation and running a cloud to the experts. But at some point, you do have shareholders, and you do have a profit target you want to make. So,
yeah. Well, it's much more fun talking about DHH than Elon today, who's also in the middle of buying Twitter. So, it's a fantastic week. Well, I guess I'll talk to you guys next week.
Yep. See you later.
All right. Later.